Okay. It is impossible to do justice to Parshas Bereishis. The entire Torah, of course, is deeper than we can imagine. Any Parsha that we would pick, we can't do justice to, and even our method of just focusing on one Aliyah at a time. There's infinite content to discuss beyond what we could ever do justice to. But Parshas Bereishis, I think it's fair to say, is unique in its mysteriousness and in its significance, literally, in the history of the world. And in the challenge that's involved in trying to interpret the psukim, trying to interpret them on a pshat level, trying to understand them on a mystical level, trying to embrace the full message of the story of creation in all of its details and in all of its content, is way beyond us. So recognizing that and acknowledging that, we're even not starting from the beginning of the beginning, not from the Bereishis of Bereishis of the first Aliyah, but even just picking up from the second Aliyah. We mentioned during Seder that the Aliyahs are divided differently in different Chumashim, but the second Aliyah, we are understanding it as beginning from Perek Bey's Pasuk Ballad. So even just starting from there, it's a tremendous challenge to interpret what exactly is going on. So we are going to do our best to call attention to some of the many, many issues and the many points and the many themes that come up in this Aliyah, and we'll do what we can in the time that we have, and hopefully we'll also find more opportunities to expand on some of the themes as time allows. So just to begin with, if you have Chumash, so the second Aliyah begins with Pasuk Dalet. Eila told us Hashemayim v'aretz bihi baram v'yom esos Hashem Elokim eretz Hashemayim. So these are the toldos of heaven and the earth as they are created, or as they had been created in the day that Hashem made, the day that Hashem Elokim made the Eretz and Shemayim. So what does any of that convey? So here alone we could spend the whole morning trying to work out what the message of this pasuk is. So we'll just try to say a little bit about it. So one of the themes is, what does the word toldos mean? So most of the Rishonim understand that toldos, in some usages in Chumash, you think it means the history of, but we know that more literally, toldos means the descendants of, or the product of, both in terms of human beings, and we also find this in terms of concepts, and everything in between. So here, most of the Rishonim understand, and Avshalom Shnufal Hirsch emphasizes, that it means that Hashem created the heaven and the earth, and that everything that happens afterwards happens as a product of that. That's toldos, or at least that's what's discussed here, is a product of these creations. And they are essentially passive producers, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu put this into motion through this system. And it's what allows the world to seemingly function on its own, even though it's really happening through HaKadosh Baruch Hu's discretion and initiation. And as Rav Hirsch discusses, so that's why it takes like an Avram Avinu to be able to appreciate that there is a God behind everything, because this is the nature how the system is set up, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put these elements into place and allowed the products that come afterwards to seem to emerge from that. The Yerushalmi in the Saches Brachos, at the very beginning of Yerushalmi Brachos, it focuses on the day, on the language of Bibaram, Biyomasos Hashem Elokim Eretz Hashemayim, that here we see some of the contrast between a divine product and a human product, that a human manufactures something, as time goes on, it rusts, it degrades, it's not going to be in the same form. But the world continues to be the same world that God created. We won't get into some of the questions of climate change or other aspects of whether or not there are fundamental differences in the world over the time, over the course of generations and centuries, and millennia. But at least on a fundamental level, the fact that the world is the same world as the day that God created it, that's an indication of the fundamental difference between God and a human being, or one of the indications of one of the fundamental differences. And the notion of the creation of the Shamayim and Aretz, so there is a this idea that one comes, everything else comes from this. So there is a machlokas in the Medrash between Reb Lazar and Yehoshua, that the Reb Lazar understood that everything that's in the heavens comes from the Shamayim, and everything that's in the earth comes from the Aretz. And Yehoshua disagreed. He says it's all from Shamayim. And Yaakov Kamenetsky has a long discussion about this in his Sefer Emes LeYaakov, where he suggests that there is a fundamental machlokas here between Reb Lazar and Yehoshua about the relationship of Gashmias and Ruchnias, about spiritual elements and physical elements and how exactly they're interconnected. And it comes up in a number of contexts, such as, for example, the machlokas about how Yontif should be treated. Is Yontif O Kula Chem, O Kula Shem, something that's either completely spiritual or completely physical, as opposed to the view of Rabbi Yeshua that it's a mixture of both, that they coexist as one unit, and that we say that Yontif has to be Chasi L'Chem or Chasi L'Shem, because that's its nature. So he goes through various other examples where he displays that this seems to be a machlokas l'shitasim in general, and that that's a part of what's conveyed in the pasuk. He has some interesting examples. It's a longish essay in the Sefer Emes LeYaakov. Also, we find here the idea of Hashem Elokim, Emidas Adin, Emidas Arachamim, and Chazal emphasized that this reflects the fact that Kodesh Baruch Hu was originally, so to speak, whatever this means, was going to originally create the world alpi midas hadin, and then it became clear that the world would not survive. We can't endure under a system of din. So then Kodesh Baruch Hu combined it with the midas harachamim. And some explain this reflects the idea that if humanity, by its very nature, and it's one of the major themes in this parsha and in all of Jewish philosophy, if humanity is to have bechira chavshis, is to have free will, so then a part of that is the reality that there's going to be stumbling, there's going to be falling. And if we're going to have only amidas hadin, then we're not going to survive. So a part of what's inherent in creation is that we are zochet aschar because we have free will. Free will means that we're going to make mistakes. If we're going to make mistakes, the world's not going to exist if it's going to be purely midas adin. So inherent in how creation takes place is the necessity of the partnership between the midas adin and the midas harachamim. And that's what this medrash is suggesting. Also, some of the words here are themselves subject to very extensive discussion. One of the most controversial and debated ideas in terms of the literal reading of the Torah in creation is, what is a day? So when it says here, Biyom, Asos Hashem Elokim Eretz Hashamayim, God created them in a day. So does that mean literally a day, like we relate to it nowadays, a day of 24 hours? Or does it mean something else, like Rav Sajagon and others understood, that it means a time period, and that time period doesn't necessarily have to be defined the way we talk about a day calendarically, that it's one 24-hour slot, but it could be a time period of much greater length, and that could also be referred to as a yom, like we sometimes find in other places in Tanakh, that we talk about yom as, you know, someday this will happen. We don't mean on this specific date, we mean that there'll be a time when this will be different, when there'll be a certain reality. So the word Yom could perhaps be understood differently. And what about the word Asos? So why did the pasuk seem to essentially repeat itself? So why do we have to be told that God created the world and he made the world? So many of the Rishonim understand, just to give a little Mar Maka, many of the Rishonim understand that there's a difference between Bria and Osia, that there's the different ways to explain the difference. Some say that the Bria is the initial creation out of nothing, and then the Asiya is the perfecting of the process. Other Rishonim explain it differently, but that's a part of the discussion. So every word of this pasuk really is subject to many different interpretations, but these are among the issues. You know, what exactly are we referring to as far as being made? If so, why does the pasuk have to repeat the idea of creation? And is that what's happening, or are there different connotations for the different words here? And all of this is among the many discussions that the Rishonim have trying to interpret this pasuk. Okay, but in the interest of time, we'll have to look at the other pesukim also. So the next pasuk says, "V'chol siach atzade terem yia ba'aretz." So that which grows in the field has not yet shown up. "V'chol eisav hatzade terem yitzmach," and the grass has not grown yet. "Ki lo himter Hashem elokim al ha'aretz," because God has not yet brought any rain on the land. "V'adam ayin la'avodas ha'adama," and there is no person to work the field, which is fascinating. What exactly would that mean? Rashi here understands that there's no human being to appreciate what's being created, which is reflective of the idea that we need appreciation for there to be a value in creation in the first place. Putner used to say, believe that Asur Ligmal Tov L'Misha Eino Makir Tov, that we can't provide goodness to someone who's not able to appreciate it. And here we find at the very beginning of creation that without a human being to be able to indeed have that appreciation, so then there wasn't a point in bringing forth all of this growth. And here when it says Avodas Adama, so the Mefarshim understand that would have to mean Tfilat. Perhaps Levinstein explained it, that we're talking about at this stage, it would mean to connect to a Kadosh Baruch Hu and to appreciate him. And Rav Elie Lopian explained also that this appreciation is so crucial that that's why Adam HaRishon is not allowed back into the Gan after the Chet. You know, there's a lot to talk about how Parshas Bereishis, in a sense, is a very depressing note to pick up on after the Yom Narayim, that here we just had a whole month devoted to themes of tshuva, and that it's possible for us to come back from the chait. And then we have Parshas Bereishis, which seems to contradict that, because here Adam HaRishon sins, and seems to do tshuva, that's what we're told. And yet, it can't go back to where he started. He's not allowed back into the Gan. And there's a lot to say about that, probably for a different time. But just in this context, Elie Lopian commented that if appreciation is such a crucial part here, that Adam HaRishon was, as Chazal put it, was kafui tov. He was somebody who didn't have a full appreciation, as we see later on. And he refers to Chava, the great gift that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him, refers to her as Haisha Asher Nasata Imad, you know, that woman that you put with me, she's the one who's the cause of all my problems. So if somebody doesn't have the ability to be Makir Tov, so then that's going to be a fundamental problem for his continued presence in Gan Eden. And even if he did Shuv, even if he was forgiven, but still there's a character issue that's going to get in the way. It's one of the many interpretations, a big discussion, why exactly it is that the tshuva didn't seem to fully help. Ve'ei yalem in ha'aretz, so there was vapor that came up from the land. Ve'hishkez kol p'nei ha'adama, and that watered the ground. And now here, crucial pasuk for us. Ve'yitzar Hashem elokim es ha'adam, ofrem in ha'adama, So God then formed man, and he made him from the dust of the ground, and he breathed into his face nishmas chayim, the breath of life. So the person became a living person. So here there is a crucial comment of Unklus that we cannot pass by without noting. One of the most often quoted Uncluses, Unkuli, I guess, that Unklus comments over here, Nefesh Chaya, what does that mean? What is that? How do we translate that phrase? So it says Unklus, L'ruach M'maula, that he became a speaking creature. And this is the statement that launched 100 Shmuzin. There are many, many discussions in the Sifrei HaHashkafa and HaMusar that focus on this, that one of the defining aspects of humanity is the ability to speak, which doesn't necessarily have to only focus on the physical ability to speak. But speaking is a tool of thought and a tool of expression. And it's often explained, Al Pi Hashkafa, why it is that we are so concerned about the prohibition of Lashon Hara. That we know that Lashon Hara, the Gemara says, hurts or kills, so to speak, three people. It kills the subject that you're talking about. It kills the mekabel, the one receiving it. And it also kills the speaker. So how exactly does it kill the speaker? There's a lot you could say about this. We've probably talked about it a little bit already in the past. But one of the notions is that because our humanity is so tied in to our expression, an expression of thoughts and ideas, that if that tool is corrupted, if that tool is used for evil, so to speak, is used for Lashon Hara, so then that goes to one of the fundamental characteristics of humanity, that the individual who engages in improper speech, we spoke of before Yantav, we spoke about Nifl Peh and how important that is to avoid, but also if one speaks unfairly about other people, so one has degraded this crucial aspect of his humanity to such a degree, has a tremendous impact, and it's very serious. And there is a whole discussion. The Ramban over here talks about the Kuzri, and like others, and they talk about the idea. The Kuzri talks about different types of creations, and a medaber is defined in a fundamentally different way than an animal that doesn't talk. So there is a whole discussion when you kind of have this hierarchical system of creation. We're not just assuming that they're just quantitative differences, that it's just that one is at a greater level than the one before it, but a qualitative difference. It's a whole different thing. So a human being is not just an animal plus. It's a whole different type of creation than an animal. Just like an animal is not a plant plus, just because they're both alive. We don't say that an animal is a plant, but a little more. An animal is a whole different kind of creation than a plant. So this is a whole discussion the Ramban, the Kuzri, and others have about the significance of this defining factor and just how much it goes to establish this core of humanity. And it's also invoked, the halacha. There is literature that's pretty extensive. There are a number of tshuvas that are written about the question. If you're very desperate for a minyan, can all relate, sometimes you just want to daven, you can't get a minyan. So why don't you just make a golem? You've probably confronted this from time to time. You're wondering, why should we have to wait around for a tenth man? Why don't I just make a golem? And that would solve all the problems. So it's the obvious solution. We would just do that without worrying about it. So it must be that it's not so partial halakhically. So there is extensive literature about this. The Chazanish talked about this, and looking backwards in history, the Ragashavar Golem talked about this. And before them, there was a number of tshuvas written, including father and son tshuvas by Yudak Remzin and his father, the Chacham Tzvi. Both talked about this, and they discussed how an ancestor of theirs had made a golem. And the Gemara in the Maseches Sanhedrin that talks about the creation of a person from the Sefer Yetzira. And there, what's highlighted is the fact that the golem couldn't talk, that the Sefer Yetzira creation wasn't a medaber. And that factors very heavily in the Chacham Tzvi's Tshuva and much literature about whether this would be somebody who could count for a minyan. So that factor of not being a medaver weighs very heavily as far as that whole discussion. And the Rosh Hashanah always emphasizes when this discussion comes up that it's hard to believe the whole discussion, because we know that even you have human beings who are absolute human beings in every sense of the word, but they still can't be Messiah to a minion, because you have to be Jewish to be Messiah to a minion. So why are we assuming that the whole discussion of whether a golem is human or not is not going to answer the question of whether he can count for a minion? How is that going to establish whether he's Jewish or not? So that's a question, and there's some who address that question, but Rav Schechter builds on that point just to make it clear that, and sometimes unfortunately we can forget this, that to be a good Jew, you first have to be a good human being. You first have to be solid as a human, and a Jew exists in that context, that you have somebody who's first a good human being, and then being a Jew builds on top of that. You can't have one without the other. You can't have a second without the first. Okay, but in any event, so this is concept, this comment of Unklus, very, very often quoted. So, Vayita Hashem Elokim Gan Be'edin Mikedem. V'yotzem Shem, that's Adam Asher Yotzer. So, God created a garden. This garden in Eden. See here, this is often discussed also, that Eden does not mean the garden. It's a Gan in Eden. There is a Gan of Eden. And he puts there this man who he has formed, Asher Yasar. V'yitzmach Hashem Elokim min ha'adama, koleis nechma v'mare v'tov v'maychol, v'eitz ha'chayim v'tov ha'gan, v'eitz ha'das tov v'ra. So God caused all of the different types of trees to grow here. All of these trees that were beautiful to look at and also good to eat. And in the middle there is Eitz ha'chayim and v'eitz ha'das tov v'ra. And then there's also the Eitz HaDas, good and bad. Let's just translate it like that for a second. So as you could imagine, this pasuk itself, we could really spend all day talking about. And there is much that is contained within here. And so when I said to you, you'll have a good morning learning this Aliyah, so this pasuk was very much a part of the discussion. And what exactly does good mean? Even if we just choose to focus on one Hebrew word for good, tov, you could probably bring in other words also. But even if we just want to use the word tov, so what exactly does tov mean? So when I wish you a boker tov, so what is the message in the word tov? So this is a very important concept, as you can imagine. And I'll tell you, right before this whole lockdown situation, right before the whole pandemic, so I had a number of trips that were planned to be canceled, but the last trip I actually got to make before all the trips got canceled because of the pandemic, so in February I was in Europe. And the reason I was in Europe was I went to Germany, believe it or not, to speak in a university in Germany about the concept of good and evil in Judaism. What exactly is understood by those terms, good and evil, in the Jewish concept, what exactly do the words mean? So I started off saying that this pasuk already contains worlds, because the phrase of tov and ra, as it's used in Hebrew, as it's used in Psukim and Chumash, has at least two types of meanings. And you can find them throughout, but here you find in one pasuk at least two types of meanings. What do I mean? Because we talk about tov ra as, say, aesthetically pleasing, things that we like and things that we don't like. So chocolate, good. Brussels sprouts, good in a different way. Well, what exactly, when we talk about good and bad, we talk about how we like things and we don't like things. And it sounds like that the pasuk is referring to that when it talks about tov l'maychol. So there are things that we like eating, or that are good for us physically, or however you want to interpret that. So there, it seems like we're referring to moral good and bad. Although it's a topic of much debate. It's not the only way to read it, but it seems fair at least to start with an assumption that Tov and its opposite, however you want to translate that word, can refer to things that people enjoy and can refer to aesthetic beauty and those types of hedonic usages, and can also apply in a moral sense or anything in between. And that to find those usages, you don't have to look through all of Tanakh, but you'll also find that even just looking at this pasuk, so you find both invoked in the same pasuk. And it's possible to say, and this is a much longer discussion, can actually, if you're interested, the presentation they gave in Germany is actually on YouTube. But the point that one could suggest, perhaps, is that ultimately we are meant to see them as integrated. That the idea of what strikes us as pleasing and what is morally right is ideally going to come together. Now, that's not necessarily something that happens automatically. That may take a lifetime of effort. There was a major machlokes between the Rambam and others on the question of when we have, there's a lot behind this, and maybe we'll be able to talk about this at a later time because there's so much more to say, but you have proper behavior, so does it matter that you connect to that behavior as something you want to do? Or is it only important that you do the right thing and don't do the wrong thing, and we don't care about how you feel about it? So the Rambam, for one, felt that at least when it comes to moral values that we can relate to, distinct maybe from more ritual mitzvahs that we don't necessarily appreciate intellectually, but at least when it comes to moral values, that we are supposed to connect in our personality to these values, and we are supposed to be happy with that kind of behavior, even if it's not necessarily inherent, not necessarily innate that we feel that way. We may have to spend a lifetime cultivating that, but that is indeed the purpose of creation. So the idea that we find the phrases meaning two different things, indeed they do seem to mean two different things, but it is possible that they are meant to come together and that they are meant to be perceived in an integrated way, ultimately in the way we approach questions of morality and questions of the good life, so to speak. In addition to these complexities, so it's the question of what exactly is the message of calling the Eitz HaDaas Tov V'Ra. So that's got whole worlds behind it also, as you can imagine. There is even some discussion as to whether they were indeed two separate trees. And some of the Rishonim understand, Rabbeinu Bachi writes, that you can read the Pasuk, Eitz HaChaim, Eitz HaGan, Eitz HaDaas Tov V'Ra, that it's one tree, and there's two different halves of the tree, which further complicates the picture. But the idea that this is referred to as Eitz HaDaas Tov V'Ra, so what does that mean? So it sounds like it means that eating from the tree brought about some kind of change in terms of Tov V'Ra. So different Rishonim understand this different ways, whether it means that that was what allowed Adam to perceive hedonic differences and that that itself had all kinds of consequences, or whether it's referring to moral judgment. But as Rishon Shnufal Hirsch points out, that it's very difficult to say that moral judgment only came with eating the pre, for a host of reasons. First of all, it would then seem to suggest that humanity wasn't meant to have moral judgment. That doesn't seem to follow. But also, how could there have been a prohibition, and how could there have been consequences if there was no inherent moral judgment that came along with it? So it must be that there was already a sense of moral judgment, and this reference means something else. So what does it mean? So Hirsch suggests two possibilities, that maybe it means that it's being nikra al shem sofo, that ultimately this brought about the consequence of the difference between good and bad because of Adam's experience with it, so therefore it's named after that. Or it could be that even at its beginning here, so So it has a role, not necessarily in teaching the whole concept of moral judgment through consuming it, but it displayed moral distinction by its very presence, because once you have something which looks appealing, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, no, that's off limits, so that is itself conveying the process of distinguishing between right and wrong. And therefore, the tree gets that name for that reason. Okay, there's more to say about this, but it's going to come up again in the Elias. Maybe we'll go a little further and then come back to it. So then the Parsha describes the river. V'nar yotzei me'edel mahashkel sasagan, v'misham yipare v'hayir la'arba roshim. So here you have this river, and it divides up into four roshim, shem ha'echad pishon, hu ha'sovim, z'kor ta'akavila, sheshem ha'zav, v'zav ha'aretz ha'hu tov, shem ha'vdolch ha'vnashom, v'shem ha'nar ha'sheni gichon, hu ha'sovim, z'kor ha'etz kush, so here you have a listing of these four rivers, which all sounds like they come out from this one river. And this has intrigued scholars and archaeologists and historians ever since. How do you track down such a place? So Rakov Kamenetsky talks about this. He says, it seems amazing that here it's described in such detail, and yet we don't see this, we can't find this. So he suggests that maybe when the Mabul came, so all of this structure was wiped out, that especially if its purpose was there to protect the Gan, and then that was fundamentally changed, so then it wasn't necessary afterwards, so the Mabul rearranged this whole story. Rav Hirsch also talks about how scholars trying to figure out what exactly is going on here, and he notes that the assumption seems to be that you have a river with four branches, so they're looking for something that looks like that, but it's not what it means. The Arba Roshim, so Roshim are heads, they are sources. So what was going on is that you have this one river, and then it goes back into the ground, and it nourishes the ground, and then it comes out again. So it's not going to look like a tree with four branches. It's going to look like four separate rivers. Each one has a head that comes out of this river. And through that, as the Pesukim describe, so it was able to nourish all of these different territories, which all had different resources and different products. And all of that was coming from here. And apparently, the Gan was encompassing all of this. So that's a part of what the Torah is describing about the majesty and the beauty of this unique place that we don't have the opportunity to see anymore. That's a part of what's being conveyed here. Okay, so here the next pasuk goes on to say, after describing this, Vayikach Hashem Elokim es ha'adam, v'yanicheyu v'gan eden la'avdach u'lishomra. So here, again, there's a lot to say. So God took him and placed him in the Gan. Now, we already know that he's there, right? That was what the Pasuk said before, that Adam was put there. So here, it seems repetitive. So it's interesting to understand what exactly is the message here. They're saying, v'nicheyu v'gan eden. So at one point, I asked you this morning when we were learning Avos Chesed to keep in mind how there's going to be some synergy here. So we discussed this morning from the Chafetz Chaim Sefer on Chesed, that a reference to the Gemara and Sechsot and elsewhere, the Gemara tells us that we should follow in God's ways, v'alachta b'drachav, and God's ways are the ways of Chesed. So we know that because God models Chesed. God shows us how he takes care of human beings, and our obligation is also to take care of human beings. So the Gemara illustrates that point by saying that the Torah begins and ends with Chesed. We mentioned this morning how that's both metaphorical and practical, that we say something is important. We say this is the beginning and end of it. This is the whole story. And it's also chronological that the Torah begins in Bereishis with Chesed, God taking care of humanity, and ends in Vidos HaBracha with God taking care of humanity again. So in Vidos HaBracha, God is Kovar Mesim, he buries Moshe Rabbeinu, and what the Gemara refers to from the beginning is has not come yet. It's in Parshas Bereishis. It is his Malbish Arumim that God provides clothing for Adam and Chava after they realize that they need it. So some point out, you have to figure out why the Gemara doesn't say this, but some point out that why is that the first example? You could find Chesed earlier than that. So, for example, Rabbi Chalap Zayin Gezunt, he wrote in the Hakdama to one of the Sfarim that his father, Zichrono Lebracha, wrote, Sefer Chof Yomim, that was written by Rabbi Chil Michel Chalap, and son Rizul and Chalap Shlita brought them to a press, and so he quoted his father in the Hakdama to one of the Sfarim, I think the volume on Chagiga, that the idea of a Kadosh Baruch Hu's Chesed you could find even earlier, before Malbish Arumim, you could find it in this pasuk. This is a form of Hachnasas Orchin, that God put Adam in the Gan, and Vinichai, you could read also, he allowed him to rest. He gave him a place to be comfortable. And that's essentially the core of Hachnasas Orchin, which God was modeling. So God's Chesed could point to, even earlier than the Malbish Arumim, you could point to in this pasuk. So, even say more than that, Rav Soloveitchik in his writings that were published more recently in the book Abraham's Journey, I believe that's where this is found, he talks about how creation, go even earlier in the parasha, or the very beginning of the parasha, or maybe in the beginning of the Tuli also, that the creation of a planet, the creation of a world for humanity to exist upon is itself an act of Hachnasas Orchin, and Rav Soloveitchik goes into this at great length about how the idea of a Kadosh Baruch Hu creating a space, so the Kabbalistic concept of Tzimtzum, creating a space for humanity to exist, that's the ultimate act of Hachnasas Orchim. Here we mean ultimate, not in the chronological sense, but in the important sense. So it's the first act of Hachnasas Orchim, but it is the total, consummate act of Hachnasas Orchim that sets the pattern that we are supposed to appreciate and that we're supposed to follow. So the words la'avdo, la'shamra, it's a whole discussion what exactly that means, because it seems to be a grammatical issue, that the question of whether gan is zachar, and these words seem to be nekeva. So if you're able to focus on some of the issues of diktik, in the interest of time, we won't go into great detail, but you could take a look at Mar Makom. Ben Ezra says that this is actually talking about working on one's neshama, if that was what Adam HaRishon was given the context to do. Rebekah of Kamenetsky in his Sefer, and Amos Liakov, he says he thinks that that is a far-off interpretation. He says, even for Drush, thinks it's a far-off interpretation. So he goes into some detail as to what exactly that reference to. You could take a look. I'll just give you one clue, maybe very impressive to hear what he means about this, that there is a machlokus in the text. You know, the machlokus and how the Masorah should be read, we have a mapik hey for both of these words, and apparently whether there should be a mapik for in Lashon Ra is somewhat of a debate. So I will let you, if you're able to appreciate that nakuda, literally that nakuda, so then I will send you to the Sefer Emes Yaakov to look over there. So the next pasuk is very relevant to what's going on right now in ways you may not expect. So the pasuk here says, "Tazayin ve'itzav Hashem Elokim al ha'adam le'mor mikol eitz hagan achol tochel." So God commanded, saying that from everything that's from all of the trees you can eat, except. The except is in the next pasuk. So here we don't know yet there's an except, but here Adam is told he can eat from everything. So first of all, Vayitzav, that has a lot of relevance to what's going on right now, because in current events, you may not have suspected. So there is a confirmation hearing going on right now for a Chief Justice candidate for the Supreme Court Chief Justice nominee. And of course, it's very tied into the political climate, which kind of obscures some of the significance that's there. We should appreciate that there is a degree of holiness in this, because there are seven commandments, Sheva Mitzvos Bnei Noach. There are seven commandments that are given to all of humanity. And there are six prohibitions and one positive mitzvah. So the one positive mitzvah that is applicable to all of humanity is the mitzvah of din. So the one positive mitzvah from the Shavuot mitzvah in Noach, at least on the surface, there could be many, many subcategories to the Zion mitzvahs, but at least on the surface, out of the seven identified mitzvahs in Noach, so the mitzvah of din, of justice, is the only positive mitzvah. So there is a big machlokas, maybe we'll have an opportunity to talk about that in the future, a big machlokas among the Rambam, the Ramban, and many others, as to what exactly is involved in the mitzvah of din for all of humanity, for Bnei Noach. It's a separate discussion. But the court system, at least on a basic level, and the establishment of laws and of a system to enforce and to interpret those laws, is a holy mission. It is something which all of humanity is required to do. So the fact that right now the nation's attention is on the selection of a justice for the Supreme Court, it's a reflection of this mitzvah of din. And why am I mentioning it now? Because the Gemara in Sanhedrin, so it traces the source for all of the Sheva Mitzvah Noach from the language of Sukkim and Bereishis and Noach. And one possibility, it's Machlokes in the Gemara, but one possibility is this language of Vayitzav Hashem Elokim Elo Adam, that is a reference to the whole notion of din, that God commanded a whole legal system. And this, what continues in the pasuk, is representative of it, but the notion of there being a commandment to humanity, to Adam, of a legal system and of a structure of justice is alluded to and is learned from this language of the Yitzav Hashem Elokim Elo Adam. So just something to be aware of. And then the pasuk continues, a different philosophical importance, that all of that is in the Gan you should eat from, and the next pasuk is going to tell the exception. So you might see that as, they call an Isra Aseh, that there are things that we know you're not allowed to do because the Torah tells you this you can do and that you can't do. So here it would be both. The next pasuk giving the Los Aseh part telling you not to do, and this pasuk saying everything else is what you can do, and understand that there's something that's excluded. But the Meshech Chachma and others understand that, no, there's a more positive message here, that separate from the prohibition, there is a positive value that which is permitted, you are supposed to benefit from. And this is a whole attitude that we find in Chazal in many places, that the permitted hanas are not simply take it or leave it, but that we are supposed to avail ourselves of that which is permitted. And therefore, that's included in this message, that it's not just, okay, so what we discussed earlier in the week, called Mosi Gareis, okay, I'll just stay away from everything. That, no, the rest you are supposed to enjoy. And it has to be within the context and the discipline of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is prohibiting and allowing, and in that sense also essentially recommending. So here the next pasuk says, "Mi'et Sadas Tovera, Lo Sochem Imenu, Ki B'Yom Achochem Imenu, Mos Tamus." So here we have this direct prohibition that he's not allowed to eat from the Eitz Hadas. So this brings up the question of what exactly was the Eitz Hadas? What kind of a tree was it? So this fruit that's going to get Adam in such trouble. So what fruit was it? So you'll ask, what do you mean, what fruit was it? Everyone knows it's an apple, right? That's the thing, right? Adam's apple and the apple of the Garden of Eden. So everyone will tell you it's an apple. Everyone except Chazal, because it's a machlokas in the Gemara and in the Medrash, what it is. And the apple is not one of the possibilities. So we can't say for sure, according to our Masorah, what kind of fruit it was, but we know that it was not an apple. So among the choices, one possibility is an etrog, and the Ramban writes in his commentary to Parshas Emor, the psukim that we read on Yontif, that the fact that we take an etrog on Sukkis, so that is as a kapara for Adam HaRishon who sinned with an etrog. So that's an interesting idea. If you look in the Sefer Paras Yosef, the original Paras Yosef, in Parshas Shemini, so he talks about that Ramban because it's not what you'd expect, because we normally have a rule of Ein Kateger Nasa Sareger, that if something was associated with a sin, so we're not going to try to invoke that as a kapara. It's going to send the wrong message. So we don't wear gold on Yom Kippur because we don't want to bring up the imagery of Egel Hazav. So why should we take a esrog on Sukkot if it's associated with the Aveir of Adam Harishon? So in the part of Yosef there, he quotes the idea, I think we had a chance a little bit to talk about this before we entered the notion of Tshuva Me'ava as opposed to Tshuva Me'ira. That Tshuva Me'ira is an escape from our past, and we're able to be absolved of our Averis. Our Averis are treated like accidents, like struggles. But there's a higher Madrega, the idea of Tshuva Me'ava. Tshuva Me'ava actually takes our Averis and makes them into Zchuyos. So Sukkos represents the idea of Tshuva Me'ava, of this active Tshuva that's not just running away from the past, but seeking to transform it into something positive. So therefore, yes, on Yom Kippur we don't wear gold, but on Sukkot, when we're focused on Tshuva Me'ava, we do take an esrog, because the message is the transformation of the problematic past into a positive future. But there are other possibilities as well. So in the Medrash, for example, differently presented than a way in the Gemara and Brachos that has this machlokas. But the Medrash quotes an opinion that it was wheat. It was a wheat tree. And then the response to that is, what are you talking about, a wheat tree? So bread doesn't grow on trees, just like bread is also used to mean money. Money doesn't grow on trees. Bread doesn't grow on trees. So bread comes from the ground. So must be. The other opinion is that it was dates. It was a tamar tree. So the idea that wheat was coming from a tree, so apparently that was how it originally was. And then after the kola, so then it changed, and the Rashi of Kaviyav, the Rav of Chol Bracha, has a discussion about this in the Sefer Asufas Marachos, where he focuses on that fact that first wheat apparently grew on trees, and then after the Kolo, after Adam HaRishon is cursed, he's going to have to work the ground, so then bread comes from the ground, comes from the whole process of getting the grain from the ground and turning it, getting the wheat from the ground, turning it into grain, turning it into bread. So the difference is that, and that's also what the expression suggests, we say money doesn't grow on trees or whatever, doesn't grow on trees. So even though you have to plant trees, it takes some effort to do that. But apparently, from an agricultural farmer perspective, it's much more work to grow things from the ground than it is to grow things from trees. So the idea of bread shifting from coming off of trees to coming from the ground meant a very significant shift in how much human effort is required. And that's consistent with the klala, the idea that b'zayas apacha techolachem, that now Adam's going to have to work very hard to get bread. And the idea, as the Rashiva discusses, and he brings some other interesting applications of this, is that ideally, so all of what we have will be there to allow us to focus on our ruchnius, and that we have our gashmius provided for us, so that we are able to cultivate our ruchnius in a undistracted state and to grow from that. But if we are not oriented properly and we're going to follow the Yetzer Hara and we're going to take the available resources and use them improperly, so then we're no longer in the same position. And instead, we have to be taken out of our comfort. We have to be forced to work. And like Chazal tell us that batala mevu deishimam, that when a person doesn't have the distraction of work, so then they tend towards bad behavior. So if you're on a madrega where you're going to behave in an exalted way no matter what, so then you don't need this distraction of being tied down to the physical labor. But like Adam HaRishon is showing, that he doesn't have that discipline yet, he doesn't have that ability to resist the Yetzer Hara, so then we need to be directed into distracting labor, so to speak, into being occupied in order to keep us away from that which could be a michshol. So this is something that we ultimately seek to correct as a part of our journey here on earth, and then we anticipate the Zman HaMashiach and Olam Haba, where we are back to the state that Adam HaRishon was originally in, where we have all our needs taken care of, and that we're able then to focus on growing spiritually because we don't have the need to be distracted by all of the physical labor. So that imagery is perhaps all suggested. Okay, so just a lot more that can be said in these next two sukkim and finish off the Aliyah, but especially this next one. So Vayomer Hashem Elokim, here, very, very often quoted pasuk, and brings us back to the question of what does the word Tov mean. So Vayomer Hashem Elokim, Lo Tov Heyos Ha'odom Levado, Eser Lo Ezer Kenegdo. So it's not good for man to be alone. I will make for him an Ezer Kenegdo. So what does it mean saying it's not good for man to be alone? So as we mentioned a few minutes ago, in the earlier pasuk that uses Tov twice in the same pasuk. So Tov seems to mean a lot of different things. And Tov can refer to many different spheres of life where things are perceived as good and bad. And it would seem, Rabbi Lichtenstein Shulchan Aruch wrote in an essay about this, that this is a reference to moral and psychological good, that a person shouldn't be alone, shouldn't be without a helpmate. And many point out that it's a reference to spiritual good also, that because you're connected to someone else and you have to worry about their needs and their perspectives, so that makes you into a better person. And because no man is an island, not just in terms of marriage, but also in terms of their broader communal connections, no man is meant to be completely isolated from everyone else. So you're forced to not be selfish. You're forced to think about the needs and the priorities of others and to factor that into your life, but also factor that into your perspectives and your understandings, and to become a more refined personality by the nature of that interaction. And that's one of the major reasons why we say that the notion of marriage is one that creates a new person out of both of the parties, that they become elevated individuals through that process. And we have a tradition of fasting on the day of the wedding because of the idea that there is a, one interpretation is that it's associated with the notion there's a kapara, there's an atonement that comes at that time because the individual is now taking on a whole new status and a whole new level of behavior. So the idea of connecting to someone else in a fundamental way is crucial for the ability to grow. And in addition to that, so the Svarim also talk about, the Rav Gifter actually talks about this in the Sefer Pirkei Torah, he quotes from the Reish Chachma, that the notion of romantic love as a mashal for how to relate to a Kadosh Baruch Hu, or as a little bit of an opening into what that could mean, so that is also crucial for spiritual growth. And that's also what the pasuk is indicating. That's also part of this notion of lo tov heyos adam levado. Somebody who is levad and somebody doesn't have any shaychus to that concept is fundamentally flawed. He quotes Lashonis to this effect, is fundamentally flawed in his ability to appreciate spirituality. So eselo ezer kenegdo. So I will create for him a helpmate. So Rashi quotes the idea that ezer kenegdo, as I'll point out, seems to be what you'd call an oxymoron, seems to be a contradiction in terms, because Ezer means to help, and Keneged means opposite, means to be an opponent, means to try to thwart someone else. So which is it? Is it Ezer or is it Kenegdo? So the Gemara has a language, the Rashi quotes, that depends on how meritorious you are, that Zacha, nice and low, that if you're worthy, so it's going to be good. If you're not worthy, it's going to be bad. And this is brought to the Goyoni HaShastri Yosef Engel in his commentary to Ksubas. So he quotes from the Tshuvas Halachot Ketanas. He says, well, why don't you make a Shechianu at a wedding? Now, some do. It's a question of a minhag also. But the notion of not making a Shechianu, kind of the problem in practice, not making a Shechianu at a wedding, he says, because we don't know yet how it's going to turn out. Because this is what Chazal say. It could either be good or bad, depending on the notion of schos, but since that's still undetermined, so therefore you're not making a shechianu yet. But Schefter often quotes the idea that when told zacha ezer lo zacha kenegdo, it doesn't mean that if you have schos it's going to be good. If you don't have schos it's going to be bad. It means that either way it should be good. So if a person is trying to do the right thing, so then his wife should help him do the right thing. And if he's trying to do the wrong thing, so then his wife has to be connected. His wife's going to have to oppose him doing the wrong thing and bring him back on the proper path. So either way, it's supposed to turn out well. It's the question of what kind of attitude does the individual need. Does he need somebody who is helping him or somebody who is opposing him? And of course, we all need both at different times. We're all in different places at different times. And it's not just about marriage, it's about friendship as a whole. So that's how many of the commentaries also note that this is talking here in the context of marriage, but it's not only true in that context, that a man benefits from companionship and from interaction and from a social context, as the Rambam discusses in many often cited quotations in his commentary to the Mishnah and Pirkei Avos and elsewhere about the various benefits that come from companionship. And as the Brisker Rav notes, based on a question of the Ramban, that it seems that the Pasuk seems a little bit misfocused to say that, okay, God creates a partner for Adam and tells us because it's not good to be alone. Well, why is that the focus here? Isn't it also, if we're going to have Pur Ru, if we're going to have a population of the world, so then you need to have man and woman, so then that's enough reason. So why is a pasuk say lo tov hayos adam levado, unless what the message is that, yeah, that's also true, that it's not only for the perpetuation of the species, but it's because companionship and also the notion of romantic love as well, all of that is being messaged here as inherently valuable, and not only because of the need for Puruvu and for populating the world. So clearly a lot to say about this, but these are just some of the main concepts. So just to finish off the Aliyah, as we have it here, Ve'yitzer Hashem Elokim al Adama, Kol Chayaso Soda, Ve'yitz Kol Ofa Shemayim, Ve'yavei al Adam Liros Ma Yikrulo, V'chol Asher Yikrulo Adam, Nefesh Chayahu Shmo. So the Pasuk ends off, and there's a lot to say about this also, but we're just about out of time, so we'll end on this note. But the notion of Adam being tasked with the job of giving names to all of creation, giving names to all the animals, that is apparently a crucial part of his role, which is a fascinating idea in itself. Hopefully we'll have the opportunity to expand on that a little bit, but it also goes back to one of the themes we saw earlier, that the world exists so that humanity can appreciate it and can relate to it and can know what to do with it. So therefore, this notion of Adam giving names to creation becomes a very crucial part of the process. So I hope that I can wish you a good Shabbos now with somewhat of a deeper understanding of what good means, or at least somewhat of a recognition that there are many different aspects of goodness, and I wish for you a good Shabbos in all of the themes, in all of its many meanings. It should be a pleasant Shabbos, it should be an enjoyable Shabbos, it should be a safe Shabbos, it should be a spiritually and morally good Shabbos. Should have all types of goodness, and God willing, I look forward to seeing you on Sunday.
Thank you, Rabbi. Have a great Shabbos.
Thank you. A great Shabbos, even better than good. Cult of.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Cult of, in all the senses of the word.